Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Everyone, thanks for listening to the Western Hunting Hub podcast. And this is a bonus episode that we will be doing once a month, a little partnership project with Howl for Wildlife. And I have John Salone on the phone here to introduce what that project is.
Hey, Clint, thanks for having us on, and thanks for being a participant in this. So once a month, Howl for Wildlife's podcast, Howlcast, is going to be producing a bill review or an action review type podcast where we're going to dive into either a specific action that Howl for Wildlife is working on, or it might be even multiple where there's not, like, you don't need necessarily need a ton of explanation for it. And we're really just giving you the meat and potatoes of what is going on with that bill or with that rule change or whatever it may be. The program that we're doing with you and with other podcasts in the industry is something nobody's ever seen before. We're basically syndicating this episode out to guys like yourself. Mm-hmm. And the beauty about that whole thing is, yes, you know, it's great for us to get the exposure, but I think that the message of unity starts with us, content providers, us influencers, that if we, you know, because people have gotten used to their favorite influencers pushing whatever is important to them, right?
Right.
So I think it's beautiful that guys like yourself are getting involved to put this out there and not, it's not just, hey, this is what I represent, these are the companies that I represent, blah, blah, blah. These are my sponsors. Everybody's taking the time out because they know how important this is. And it's showing this greater unity that I think, that we hope anyway, is going to translate down to, you know, the hunters and anglers that are getting involved in these bills. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's it in a nutshell, really.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to have this probably mid to late part of the month or whatever. We'll get in a schedule, but so nice little short, would you say 15 minutes or so roughly of a just a little update. And we just wanted to throw out a little quick intro of what we were doing before we just shoved them right in the middle.
Yeah, it really depends on what we're talking about, what the issue is, or issues. This first one that we did is going over a few different bills at once, so it's a little bit longer.
Sure.
And if it needs to be deep dive, we'll deep dive into one that might be a little bit longer. But typically, we're trying to keep them, 30 minutes or less.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I think just like you said, this is important information, and I am happy to share it, and happy to. I'm more excited to just get my own update on this. It's hard to read all emails. It's hard to just go to a specific place to listen to it when here my podcast, other podcasts, wherever you're already kind of absorbing content, it's all there. And you just, there's the next episode. Give it a listen, and away we go. So that's what...
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a nice convenience thing and an important piece of information that'll be getting out. So everyone, make sure you tune into these bonus episodes. They're not going to be given a number or anything, just I don't even know quite how I'm going to name them or put them in there, but they will be, I'm sure, linked. I'll have links back to... Howl for Wildlife, where you can go and sign the petitions and get engaged in that way. And it's been very easy. My favorite mug now is my Howl for Wildlife mug. And on the back, it says, take action while drinking this cup. I know these are just like Shutterfly mugs, but they are now my favorite. Just fits my big hands perfectly. And so I got my mug, and it's nice to have that little reminder. It's like, oh yeah, I should see what's going on. Or I see an email come through and go and sign a quick thing, knowing I'm doing some things for the better. And on top of that, I get some emails back, just like we talked about and Charles and I talked about, where you're getting emails back from some of these decision makers, and it's kind of interesting, some of that conversation that can begin, or really learning from those lawmakers as well. So there, it makes for some ways of staying connected even more. So I like it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been a great journey so far this last 6 months, and with stuff like this, I have a lot of hope that the hunting fishing community is going to continue to not only survive but thrive. So
right. So anything else to add quick before we let them listen to the first one?
No, I think that's it. Just be good to each other.
Perfect. All right, well, here it is.
Hi, I'm John Stallone. Welcome to Howl for Wildlife's Conservation Corner. Your favorite host has stepped up to support your hunting and fishing heritage by agreeing to share our message on their platform. Each month, we will be releasing a show discussing the current issues surrounding hunting and fishing. So be sure to thank them for all they do, and thank you for tuning in. Now let's jump into this episode. Hi, welcome to Howl for Wildlife's Action Center Review. I have Travis Hall with us on, and Travis is one of our bill researchers and content writers, and so he has hands-on experience with the current bills we are working on in our Action Center. So what's going on, man?
Hey, John, how's it going? Appreciate you having me on here today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think moving forward, now we're doing this this Action Center Review we're going to be doing it like once a month, and so we're going to probably have you on more often since you're directly involved with them. So
awesome. Yeah, I'd love to be on whenever the need arises.
Awesome. So I guess let's get a little quick rundown about you, so people know who we're talking with, and then we'll jump into some of these actions that we're working on.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm a freelance writer, and I write primarily about hunting, fishing, conservation related content. Obviously I write for you guys, in the Action Center quite a bit. here lately, and do a lot of writing for Meat Eater as well. And I've had a few articles in Field and Stream here lately, so I do that. And then I also report for some local publications. I'm based out of Montana, Western Montana, so you know, I'm writing about hunting and conservation for a few local outlets as well here. So
awesome. Yeah. So we got a bunch of stuff going on still, which is crazy. I didn't think this late in the season we would have this many many things going on, but you know, typically bill season's like what, January through April for the most part, and here we are mid-June. Yeah. So let's talk about this. Let's the North Carolina bear one. We'll start off with that, and if you could give us an overview of that bill, and then we'll kind of dive into it a little bit.
Yeah, so that bill, it was basically a response to an action by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, which is just the state agency that administers the wildlife there in North Carolina. But, you know, it's been several months now, but they have expanded, or they're attempting to expand their bear hunting opportunity in the western part of the state. Western North Carolina's mountainous terrain, quite a bit of public land, at least for, you know, eastern standards. They've got about 1 million acres between the Pisgah and the Nantahala National Forest there. But the commission decided that because bear populations have been expanding, growing in North Carolina, they wanted to open up some opportunities in a few areas that had formerly been designated as sanctuaries. That was the terminology used in the 1970s when they kind of set this up. But these were areas that were off limits to bear hunting for a long time. But now, since numbers have rebounded so well, the Wildlife Commission decided to open up some limited opportunity hunting there, some like limited entry draw stuff. When they did that, they were challenged by a lot of animal rights groups in that area. They just met a lot of opposition. Local media kind of latched on to the controversy of it all, as they tend to do, and it got a little blown out of proportion, I would say.
Yeah.
But you know, it passed either way within the commission, and the rule should have gone into effect. But then it got challenged in the legislature by the same animal rights group. They sent in quite a few letters, hundreds of letters, that caused the rule to go into a review process with the legislature. So then after that, a bill was introduced to kind of strike this rule down. But that's not a given yet. So they just have to, you know, kind of keep an eye on that one.
Right. And so I noticed that I had read some articles about it that were basically, it was a lot of people were misunderstanding what was going on, and that's why they were so up in arms about it. Like, I think the word sanctuary was throwing people off, is that we were going to go, you know, hunt in these like fenced off, you know, places and stuff like that. There was quite a bit of that I saw going around. Do you know, do you have the numbers of what the bear population was and what it's become in these areas?
You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but when I was reporting on this at the time, I talked to a bear biologist there, and she told me that, you know, in the 1970s, they were dwindling. I mean, the black bear in North Carolina was all but gone from the area. And that's when they designated those sanctuaries. And like you said, that terminology is a little problematic now, because it makes people think of like a national park or somewhere, you know, somewhere that hunting should never be allowed. But when they designated them in the 70s, it was with the understanding that once these populations rebounded, there would be some hunting opportunity allowed, and that's just kind of, that's where they're at now. And I don't have the exact numbers, but I've been told by bear biologists in the state that they're thriving. Mm-hmm. Bear numbers, particularly in the western part of the state. This was just designed to kind of address that and manage that population, because human bear conflict seems to be on the rise there, particularly near the Smoky Mountains.
Yeah, I remember now. Don't quote me on the numbers, but from what I understood, from what I was reading, it went from like 5,000 animals in like the 90s to like 30,000 today.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's crazy, crazy exploded.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, don't quote us on this. Look it up, but I know it's pretty, pretty darn close to those numbers. Something very, large gap between, you know, when the last time they did a survey or whatever in the 90s to the last survey, you know, 2020, I think it was maybe.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And I mean, what they're proposing to do here, it's pretty limited, really. I mean, I think it's like three or four of these. They're now calling them designated bear management areas. The commission officially changed that terminology away from sanctuaries, but I think they're only opening three or four of them for some pretty limited lottery hunts.
Right.
So it's not, you know, they already have a very long standing culture of bear hunting with hounds there in North Carolina. So they do a good job of managing their populations. I think they're just trying to stay on top of it as it continues to grow.
Right. Right. So basically, you know, if they are, doesn't sound like they are, sounds like we're probably going to win this one here, but if we don't, you know, there's definitely going to be more bear human interaction, because a lot of that sanctuary area or those designated bear areas are almost landlocked in a way with private lands.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, there is some public land opportunity in North Carolina. But you know, historically bear hunters have seen their access to, places that they used to hunt on private land. They've seen that access dwindle just in the face of development and a growing human population there.
Which, yeah, it's pretty much the case everywhere.
Yeah. You can't escape that.
God. Yeah. It's so crazy. So let's talk about the next one here. It's that Utah's got something going on. I think that's the Houses Act, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's Senator Mike Lee's Houses Act, which I guess was introduced to the Senate in April, of this year.
Okay. And if you could tell us what that's about. And
yeah, basically that, is a bill that he has put forth in the U.S. Senate that proposes to take some federally managed BLM land and free it up for purchase by state and local municipalities there in Utah, where he's a senator in Utah. So it kind of focuses on Utah, but it wouldn't be exclusive to Utah. But it would basically make those lands affordable to the municipalities, which would then be required to sell that land to developers specifically for housing development. So that's federally managed BLM land across the West that would potentially become housing developments if this bill were to go through.
Yeah. So you know, I know it sounds like it might be pretty obvious, but like, let's talk about how that affects us and maybe get into like the long-term implications of that for wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, if the bill were to go through, it represents pretty significant risk to wildlife habitat, obviously, not just in Utah, but all over the Western U.S. These animals rely on public land for all kinds of things, from just their natural everyday forage to winter range. So once you start taking land out of public hands and putting housing developments on it, which this is what this bill proposes, then you obviously have that habitat loss that comes along with that kind of thing. And then there's a big loss of access for hunters and other outdoor recreators that have traditionally used this type of land. So it's kind of twofold, between the habitat loss for our wildlife and our loss of traditional access to these lands.
Yes. I mean, this is not just a Utah thing, right? So we could potentially, as hunters and sportsmen, potentially lose thousands and thousands of acres that are open for us to hunt.
Right.
And
yeah, I mean, I'm sorry,
with that obviously comes the ramifications for the wildlife using those, that landscape, because we already know, you know, especially like mule deer are very affected by defragmentation of their landscape.
Right.
They're not as adaptable as the whitetail or whatever that'll, you know, sleep underneath your back deck, because you know, that's how they are. And
right.
Mule deer just don't do that. I mean, some of them do. Some of them kind of grown up that way, and you'll see that in like Estes Park area and stuff like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, this is bad. This is a very, very, very bad bill. Like, if it goes through, I think this is definitely one that the troops need to rally behind. And I haven't really seen a lot of movement from us on it, to be honest with you. I know from Howlful Wildlife specifically, I'll pull that up right now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I was wondering how many signatures it has.
Not a whole lot. Almost 2,300, which is when it's something this, you know, egregious or, you know, impactful, I guess is a better way to put it.
Right.
To hunters and wildlife directly, like I think we need to really get on this one here, guys. So, you know, don't sit on your hocks.
It's an important thing to try to fight this. I mean, Mike Lee has a long-standing history throughout his tenure in the Senate of trying to transfer federally managed land out of federal hands, kind of into the state, or in this case, local municipalities, where it can then be sold off to private interests. And once it's gone forever.
Yeah.
And it's access that's lost, and it's wildlife habitat, and both of those things are, you know, already dwindling. So
do you know if BHA is working on that at all?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like right in their wheelhouse of what their mission is. But I don't know.
They've been definitely on top of this one since the bill was introduced, and even, you know, I heard some rumblings about it before it was even introduced in the Senate. But they have a portal that sends people to Mike Lee, and they're sending a ton of letters. I talked to Lantani whenever I reported on this for Meat Eater back when it first made news. And he kind of indicated to me that he didn't think this bill would have much support in the Senate, and he'd be surprised if it even got out of the committee. Mm-hmm. Just, I think bills like this that kind of tend to or attempt to steal land from the American people, they just don't go over very well with people outside of Mike Lee's direct constituency. Right. Once they get a national spotlight, the uprising can be pretty fierce, and it has been in the past for similar efforts that Mike Lee and other like-minded politicians have put forth. So,
yeah, I don't know. Like, for me, I think that mentality, that it's, I know guys have been around this stuff along and, you know, have seen it. But I think that mentality is dangerous to that sit back on your hocks and just, I don't think, this is, you know, too outlandish, especially nowadays. Like, I mean, look what's going on in this world. Like, this is, I think we got to be super heated and fired up about every little thing that comes up and just fight tooth and nail.
Like, I agree.
It's one of the things that drives me insane, like, to see when I open up the Action Center and I see something like this and there's only 2,400 or 2,300 signatures or whatever. And I'm like, we have 40,000 plus members on Alpha Wildlife or members and users. You know, I'm like, why don't we have 40,000 signatures?
Right.
You know? We have 16 million hunters. Why don't we have 16 million signatures? You know, like,
right.
We shouldn't be losing anything. We should be working. Like, I mean, it is our goal to start working to get stuff that we've lost in the past back. You know? You know, this lion hunting in California or something like that. We want to be able to work on that stuff. It shouldn't be that hard to just get on here and drop a signature. This is big stuff. I know it seems like it might be easily brushed off or whatever, but it's like, I don't know. Like, there's too much of this stuff going on right now. There's a lot of land issues going on. Matter of fact, we're going to get into this next one here. I want to talk about Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on over there?
New Jersey. So there is a bill, and I believe it's in the New Jersey House. It basically takes an existing buffer zone for people that are hunting with archery equipment, say. Mm-hmm. At the moment, you have to be 150 feet from a residential dwelling, I think. Mm-hmm. With your archery equipment, you cannot hunt inside that zone. But it's going to take that and extend it out to about 450 feet. That's just one portion of it. The other, maybe even more egregious part of that bill is that it requires private landowners in the state of New Jersey to inform all adjacent property owners of their plans to hunt that property that they own. So you would have to send a letter to, or somehow inform your neighbors that you plan to deer hunt on your property. And then before you could go through with your hunting plans, you have to receive some sort of receipt from those neighbors.
Which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, I know this is not necessarily, I mean, it does affect public lands too, and I'll get into that in a minute. But to me, think about this. Let's say I'm I'm a guy that owns, I don't know, 3 acres, which doesn't sound like a lot, especially us Western guys. 3 acres is nothing, but as you're talking to a guy that hunts a 5 acre lot, has hunted 1 acre lots for whitetail back east many, many times.
Yeah.
So if I own, let's say, a 2 acre parcel, my house is on it, and my neighbor, you know, my neighbor to the right of me doesn't want me to hunt, then I can't hunt on my land, you know.
Right.
Let's or let's say that all of them agree that I could hunt, and we just went to 450 feet versus 100, or was it yards or feet? I think it's feet, isn't it?
Oh, I think it's yards, actually. I might have misspoken and said feet.
Okay.
I think it's yards.
So now when you're talking about 2 acres, depending on the relation, you know, the where my house is located on my land, let's say, or excuse me, my neighbor's house is located on his land. Let's say he's kind of right up against the boundary. Now I'm going to lose 150 yards of my own property that I cannot hunt because of this law, you know?
Right.
And it's, you know, the same thing goes for public lands. Like back east where I, or in Long Island where I hunt, there's these little tracks, you know, of couple acres, several acres of land in between housing that have a crap ton of deer, lots of deer. Suffolk County, I'm going to bring up because I'm going to speak specifically to this because I know it well. Suffolk County.
So you're originally from the Northeast.
Correct. I've been living in Arizona since 1991, so I've been here for almost 31 years. In August, it'll be 31 years.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty much a zony. I've been in Arizona for way longer than I was in New York, but I go back, and my wife is from New York too. We go back every year, and I go hunting there almost every single year. So,
yeah, and they got a lot of whitetails in New Jersey and New York. Right?
Tons. Those states, those areas have like one of the highest, if not the highest in the country for deer vehicle collisions, nuisance problems with deer eating, you know, landscaping and tick problem like you wouldn't believe. You know, so there's all this stuff there that, so these deer definitely need to be managed 100%. Matter of fact, in New York, if you shoot a doe, you bring the doe to get it checked in, they will give you another tag of either sex tag.
And wow.
You could do that twice. Like, that's how many deer are there. So you have a problem with deer, and this is the same thing with Jersey. You know, you have this issue, and you're effectively cutting off the main tool to managing this problem off at the knees by constantly whacking away at the ability to actually hunt.
Right.
You know, the problem is in these suburban areas. You can't, like, okay, oh yeah, I could still go to, you know, the national forest or go to a large tract that's, you know, thousands of acres and go hunt, but that's not where the problem of the deer is, and that's not going to fix the problem that you're having.
Right.
So
yeah, because whitetails, they like that edge habitat. They're on the edge of human occupation. Yeah, that's kind of where they congregate. So yeah. They're taking away that opportunity to manage those populations.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and now this is one of the things that I've been trying to get people to understand, going back to that little conversation we have, like, why don't we have 35,000 signatures, 40,000 signatures, is, you know, you and me, we're out here in the West, you're in Montana, I'm here in Arizona. How does this affect us, right? And people don't realize that if you lose hunters because they can no longer hunt in their state, your voice gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually that's going to trickle back to you. It's going to come in the way of legal precedents. It's going to come in the fact that there's less money being put in the pot So we all contribute into the same pot. You can't think of it, you're not doing it as in a state level. You, I mean, you are at certain, you know, tag sales or whatever, but when it comes to, you know, Pittman Robinson and stuff like that, that is a large pot that the whole country puts into, and then it gets divvied up. Well, that pot keeps getting smaller. So people need to understand that we only exist because of that pot. Because without us, there would not be a mechanism to run conservation. Mm-hmm. And it's what protects us on a great, on a grander scale. That's why we, that's why we're constantly dealing with the, you know, death by a million cuts, because they're chipping away at the edges all the time, all the time, because they can't do something like, oh, let's get rid of deer hunting, you know, because, but you start losing stuff like this and it just, people just don't want to deal with it. I can't even hunt on my own land. Why, you know, that's what I got into bow hunting for. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. So now that guy's not buying bows and he's not, you know, so
Yeah,
it's just, it's a crazy thing. So I just kind of want to just keep hitting that home for people to understand that.
Yeah. It's, like you said, the death by a thousand cuts strategy. That's their most successful. When I say they, I mean the animal, the organized animal rights activist coalition. That's their most successful route, as far as limiting opportunities. And the more convoluted and hard to discern they can make these efforts, the better for them, because they kind of tend to go under the radar.
Oh yeah.
Whenever they don't cause a huge uprising. Yeah, like this thing. Well, this is challenges private property rights and limits people's abilities to hunt on their own land, so it should cause a big uprising, but it is pretty convoluted in the language of the bill, just like most of these attacks tend to be.
Yes, for sure. So I kind of left this one for last, and we might actually touch on another one that you looked into a little bit, but the New York has the lead ban bill. I want you to describe that, and then I kind of want to kind of dive into, because at first it's like, okay, I mean, so we got to shoot copper bullets or whatever the case might be, but it's a little bit more complex. So
So the lead bans get tricky, because on first glance you tend to think, well, that's probably a good thing to limit lead on the landscape as much as possible through the use of lead ammunition. But it's kind of like anything else, in my opinion, and there are all kinds of opinions on lead. So, you know, people go in all kinds of different directions on this, but it seems like it's better kind of governed by the wildlife agencies, the state wildlife agencies, and the scientists and biologists that work there. In my opinion, I think the lead bans should be, if they're going to be put in place at all, they should be put in place by those professionals. But this is one that's kind of like, it would just be a legislative prohibition on almost all state-owned public land in New York, I think. And yeah, it would just outlaw all lead ammo use on state-owned land and all the land within the water supply that feeds into the water supply of New York City.
Right.
So yeah, a large sweeping ban on lead. And you know what that does is it tends to keep people away from hunting and fishing. It works against new hunter recruitment efforts. Obviously lead ammo is less expensive than some of the copper and other alternatives, but so it will weed out hunters, new hunters, and even existing hunters in New York.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were just talking about, the pot getting smaller.
Right. The Pittman-Robertson dollars will continue to dwindle in the face of something like this.
Yeah. And I, for those of you who are interested in it or not, on my personal podcast, Some Days in the Wild, I did a... We talked specifically about lead and lead poisoning. I had a gentleman, Dr. Brosdale, on to talk about that. And it's pretty good. We're not going to get into that right now. But if you want to listen to that, there's a lot of research as to why and you know, what and whatnot. So just, take a look at that and you'll kind of find out a little bit more about it. So the lead ban, on the grand scale of things is not a good thing for us, I guess. And, I don't know.
It doesn't seem like that, at least not this particular attempt to regulate lead. That's not to say that the lead ammo shouldn't be regulated in certain circumstances, because there's a lot of good science that shows that, you know, raptors such as condors and bald eagles that will ingest lead fragments from gut piles will ultimately die from that toxicity. But again, I think it goes back to, we need to empower our state agencies to make these decisions and not use these sweeping legislative efforts, because they tend to get co-opted, just like everything else in the legislature that has to do with hunting. The Center for Biological Diversity or whatever it might be will get behind an effort and kind of use that to advance their goals of limiting hunting opportunity. Whereas if it's just done on a case by case basis by our wildlife agencies, I think that's a better outlook for this, or solution to this lead problem that we have.
Right. Yeah. Like, obviously if there is an area that is specifically, I don't know, California condor or whatever, where that is an issue, that is a problem, that is a known problem that we're having with the lead. And
right.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the water supply. You know, we've already eliminated lead from waterfowl hunting.
Mm-hmm, you know, federal, exactly.
Those make sense to me, but you know, to go shoot a deer in the woods,
right?
That you're not going to have, you know, a condor in there, or it's not open country where you're even going to have vultures or raptors or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like a prudent thing to do, you know.
Yeah, but, and with the water supply issue in particular, there in New York City or New York State, the water that feeds to New York City. I was reading something about, you know, they have so many of these shooting ranges on public land throughout that watershed, where, you know, they go back however many decades of people just constantly shooting lead ammo. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't contaminated the water supply. So why do we have reason to believe that, you know, further big game hunting in the Adirondacks, where people are hunting white-tailed deer with lead ammo, is going to be problematic? You know, if it's not already proven from these shooting ranges that have existed for a long time.
Right. Well, cool. I do want to close with this just to bring it up. There's a bill in Washington, there's a situation in Washington that I want to touch on. I'm actually going to be doing a podcast with Bart George, who is the lion guy. We'll call him the lion guy in Washington. That we'll be specifically talking about this and have it really, flesh it out. But let's just give a quick overview. So there's a problem right now in Washington in the Blue Mountain elk herd, which used to be the largest single herd, I think, in the country.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I believe it was. and yeah. now is on the decline.
Right.
Drastically.
Yep. Yeah, it seems that way. They have an ungulate herd there that they've been studying. The department, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, has been studying pretty heavily over the last year, monitoring calf growth rate, I think. So they collared a whole bunch of calves and elk calves in that herd, and found that their predation rates are just kind of through the roof. Something crazy, like, I don't know, 80% or more of these calves had succumbed to some form of predation, and a pretty huge number, portion of that was attributed to mountain lion predation.
Yeah, I got the exact numbers here. I think I just pulled it up. So, there is, hold on a second here. Oh, I thought I had it right in front of me. I'm sorry, guys. Trying to find out how many they collared. I think they collared 125 animals.
Yep.
And 92 of them or something like that was, I don't have the numbers exactly, but I have 90, I want to say 92 of them were killed by predation. Or I'm sorry, there was only 9 alive or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. Yeah, nine of them survived.
Nine of them survived. Okay, and 77 of those deaths were directly related to mountain lions.
Okay, yeah, I think what I have is 77 were as a result of some form of predation, but 55 deaths were attributed directly to cougars.
Okay, yep, you're right. That's exactly it. Sorry, guys, we should have had our numbers. I wasn't prepared to talk about this one, but I know I wanted to touch on it real quick. And the rest were black bears, wolves, and even determined that one or two of them were killed by bobcats too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. So they got a big predator problem there. Right now there's a proposition to add an additional lion tag. So, you know, there's some people out there that think, well, that's just not going to do anything because we don't even meet the quota. But if you look at it from the standpoint that this is one of the things that we need to check, the box that we need to check, it's not going to hurt anything to put another lion tag there. It's not going to hurt anyone. Heck, it might even help by putting some more money out there. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Are we going to be taking more lions if people get more tags? I don't know. Probably not. There's a couple of people that said, you know, you might see 5 or 6 more lions taken out a year. Mm-hmm. Well, 5 or 6 more lions. If you do the math, you know, let's say 6 lions times 52, that's 312 animals, you know, ungulates that you just saved. That's not a small number, you know, but, but the whole thing is, the whole premise behind it is you need to have more tags there. And let's say we put the more tags there and the, you know, in 2 years you relook at it and say, hey, well, listen, we still haven't met this objective.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go to the next step. Let's allow hound hunting again, or let's allow, because you can't hound hunt there.
Right. Yeah. It's been outlawed since the 90s, or I think.
Yeah. You know, they followed suit with California. So, but it's like, you can't make changes you know, or you can't hope that everything's going to change in one shot. But if you do this, now you have something to point to. You're like, look, we even increased the line tip. We're still not getting there. What can we do? What tool can we use? We know this is effective. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right.
So you have to have those steps to point to. And I don't think people are understanding that. A lot of people with up in arms about it saying, oh, this is just a, you know, like a shell game. It's just going to make people feel like we're doing something and we're not doing anything with it and yada, yada, yada. So from my perspective, and Hal's perspective, this is just a necessary thing that we need to do to go to the next step.
Right.
So we're supporting it.
It seems like they're in Washington. People are going to have to play the long game because that commission has some new appointees that, you know, some people don't think are really soundly rooted in the North American model of wildlife conservation. So
yeah,
people are going to have to be willing to, like you said, just engage in this step. This is one step in the process. It's not going to be a viable solution for the predator problem that they have there.
No.
But it's participation and it's an opportunity to engage and voice your opinion, I guess, if nothing else.
Exactly. Well, awesome, man. I want to thank you for coming on and going through these with us. And we'll definitely we'll get you back on here and probably next month and we'll talk about a few more other ones.
Awesome, John. Well, I've enjoyed it. I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate all the work you guys are doing and the opportunity to help craft some of these actions.
No problem at all. Then thank you for your help on them. We need it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to help.
All right, have a good one.
All right, have a good one. Bye-bye.
A deed to the land, but it ain't my ground. This is God's country.